soundtrack suggested me that it must be time for another conversation with our friend Chuck D. I'm glad I've got him for the hour to talk about whatever Chuck wants to talk about. That's generally how it goes around here. Our conversations always cover a broad array of subject matter. And speaking of a broad array of subject matter, we just talked to Mark Riley for an hour from across the pond in the UK where he now lives, and talk about covering a lot of stuff in 1 hour. It didn't do justice to all the stuff that Mark and I could have covered. We'll do that more, as I said, throughout this year. It'd be fascinating to hear his take from the UK as to how this presidential race is being covered over here. So I thank Mark Riley for that first hour, but I am thrilled, as always, to be in dialogue with our friend and brother, Chuck D. We'll get his thoughts on a number of things, including, of course, his reflections on the legacy of the progressive radio network, Air America Radio, 20 years after its launch. Mr. Chuck, how are you today, sir?
How are you, sir? My heroes, you and especially the man that was on before me, man. I couldn't get enough of listening to y'all.
No, but please. And you, it's one big mutual admiration society because we all love Chuck D. We love you. We respect you. And we appreciate you for the voice that you have been. Let me just jump right in on that and follow up on what Mark was saying a moment ago. I asked Mark why there are any number of reasons, but I asked Mark why he thought Air America Radio did not work. It was a progressive network. I celebrated its launch, hoped that it would last longer. And there are a number of reasons why it didn't. And one of the reasons is it may have been slightly ahead of its time. But the other issue that Mark put his finger on, he was just honest and transparent about it, is that Air America did not understand then this, whatever metaphor you want to use, the big house, the big tent. We live in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever. And Mark's point was that those who ran the network at the time didn't really get that. You want to agree or disagree with that, or take another approach on that, Chuck?
Well, hell, Mark said it. You know, Mark, I mean, listen, man, on my first album, Tavis, Mark Riley and Gary Bird, Hotep Gary Bird, listed on my first album as inspiration. Mm. Because during the year of 1986, putting together my first album, Yo Bum Rush the Show, I was doing messenger work in New York, and therefore my messenger work from 8 to 4, all day long, I listened to WLIB.
Oh, yeah.
Which also was, you know, because of Percy Sutton putting that in New York. The black community that got connected and did what you do right now for not only Los Angeles, but now because of technology, you're able to hear KBLA throughout the world. But, you would be lost in the gigantic city of New York as a black person, not knowing who you were, especially through the administration of Ed Koch. Mm-hmm. Also, in the period of R&B, and that was Reagan and Bush, COINTELPRO, the influx of guns and drugs in the black community. And what WLIB gave me, a political, at 25, 26 years old, a political roadmap or a GPS of what was going on. Therefore, I write my first album. Mark Riley would come on in the morning shift, 8 to 12. Gary Bird would come on in the afternoon from 1 to 4. And from the guests that came on the show, how they were able to get into the detailed dynamic of the black community and abroad, what situations do we take on? It was, like I said, Mark Riley is my sensei. So when he says, yeah, I'm a Democrat, but little D, we got that early in the game on listening to WLIB on the AM dial, Percy Sutton. So when Air America came along, it was a bittersweet situation, I found out, because they were going through some financial issues. Percy Sutton had transitioned and Pierre had taken over, and they was looking to try to expand their profile, but also be able to make some money off the signal as opposed to losing money. And it was going through a squeeze. So Mark explained it very thoroughly. I would say this, Tavis, to break it down.
Sure.
The biggest problem in the United States of America, big, small, or whatever, I still think there's an inability for white folks to learn from black people. Mm. Other than sports and entertainment. Mm. You know, like I ask, a lot of white folks, if my friends, I say, well, When have you ever sat down and a black person taught you anything? And you'd be surprised to find out how many say, I haven't. And I said, if you haven't, then are you willing to sit your ass down to take some instructions from a black person? And you might come to a point of conjecture with that, because, you know, that goes into the same category of, like, you know, what does that matter? I ask simple questions. I say, you love hip hop, right? Well, yeah. You love black people? Well, what has that got to do with it? So when it goes down to the what that got to do with it, that is pretty much an opening of a Pandora's box, which leads to the whole thing of even how Air America didn't last. I stayed at Air America even though they didn't pay me. They didn't have no money left after that first year, and I stayed on for two or three more years because I knew the signal, I knew the city, and it was the launching of my rap station and shows that I learned the mechanics and the dynamics of radio.
That's just his first response. It's going to be a good hour. It always is whenever Chuck D shows up. He said a few things already that are worthy of interrogation when we come forward. He answered this to some degree, but I want to just, again, probe dig a little deeper into this notion of what it means in this moment. We heard his story when he was 25, listening to LIB, a black talk station in New York City. But what does it mean for young black folk in their 20s now to have access to critical voices of other African Americans? And do we have enough of that? I want to just probe that, because that defines Chuck D. It helps him to write his first album, as he mentioned. What's it mean to have access to those critical voices? This notion of white people learning from black people, and they really don't have the capacity, Chuck feels, to do that outside of sports and entertainment. It leads me to ask this question that I'll pose now and let Chuck dig into it when we come forward. I was with Chuck's friend and my friend Cornell West this weekend. As a matter of fact, the last time I saw Chuck here in L.A., he and Dr. West and I were on stage together at the 10th anniversary of Black Lives Matter. The three of us were on stage together just a few months ago, it seems. And Dr. West and I were talking this weekend, Chuck, and he said the following in conversation. What can a blues nation learn from a blues people? What can a blues nation learn in this moment from a blues people? That would be us. That's the question Chuck just raised, or the issue you just raised, about what it is that they can learn from us. Let's dig into that part, as they say, when we come forward with Chuck D on Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley.
Ranked number 45 on the Heavy 100 list of the 100 most important radio talk show hosts in America. Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley, who is honored and humbled, as always, to be in conversation with Chuck D. Nobody like him. I'm just thrilled at this opportunity one more time in my career to engage him in a public conversation. So, Chuck, I want to go right to the point you made a moment ago, because I was thinking about this during the break. And that is this question that you posed, not at all rhetorically, when you ask your white friends, have you ever sat and listened and learned anything from a black person? You ever let a black person teach you anything? I was thinking during that break, Chuck, about whether or not something like Air America, a progressive talk radio network, could work today. Let me set this up right quick, and I'll yield to you. I'm doing what I can with this program, this show in syndication, and some other things I'm working on to try to build a black talk radio network. I'm working on that stuff even as we speak. And yet, I admit to you that is aimed specifically at our people. I ain't mad if other folk tune in, but it's aimed specifically at our people. Back to Air America, though, I'm thinking about whether or not it could work, a progressive network that is, work in real time. Here's my argument. On the one hand, yes, it could work now, because it may have been ahead of its time, given that America is more multicultural, multiracial, multiethnic now than ever before. So yes, it could work. That's one argument. The flip side is what you were just talking about. If the good white folk don't ever think they can learn from black folk or other people of color, and you have to have those voices on the air to make a progressive network work by reaching out to a broad array of people, then maybe it can't work if they're not prepared to listen and to learn from us, which takes me to Cornell West's question, what can, in this critical moment, a blues nation learn from a blues people? I pass the mic to you, Chuck D.
Well, I think people in this day of 2024, 2025, Tavis, we got to stay at least 9 months ahead.
Mm-hmm.
we have to maybe possibly be taught how to listen.
Mm.
Because today, people, because of technologies and gadgets having that upper hand and that overrule, as far as demographics are concerned, people, a lot of people, the masses right now, listen with their eyes.
Mm.
And it's like that old three-card Molly game you used to get, like, down in the inner city where they say, now you see it, now you don't. You could get dazzled by the lights so much that people don't even hear the detail of what is said.
Mm.
So I think everything is out there for people today. And I won't be quick to say young people, Tavis, because how young is young anyway? When I look at a 17-year-old and they give me the young excuse, I say, you ain't four. So we got to throw that right out the window, bro. Immediately get right to it. And the thing about it, you have to have a 17-year-old about a 13-year-old and say, I'm going to give this 13-year-old the same rights that you got, especially in the same household, then you'll get a big protest on that.
Mm-hmm.
So tenure and aging up means something, but in society, it's not really taught and developed. And it might be there, but are people taught to find it? So I tell people in a tech way, don't let the easy access to everything ruin your search engine.
Mm.
You know?
Say that one more again, Chuck.
We have everything.
Yeah.
We can find anybody and everybody and anything. And we can find, history, although you have to go into the details. But, all right, you go pop your gadget. But I said, don't let the easy access to everything ruin your search engine.
Wow.
Like, once upon a time, my mid-daughter, right, and this is when she was like a teenager. Now she's in her 30s. We're listening to radio, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to change the station. So I said, hold it right there. Don't try to change the station. So she's like, I don't like to hear the commercials. I said, well, this is why the commercials are there. Because she asked me, like, what does my music and radio got to do with selling sandwiches? And when I explained, to her, she said, I never thought of it that way. I said, number one, that's why I'm here to tell you.
But yeah.
She started to listen to radio in a different way. But today, with sight, story, style, and sound coming through, only two gadgets. We know what people are. We said, listen, consumers have consumed two, not three, gadgets. It's either iPhone or Android. And now, new generations have been taught to get everything through those one or two gadgets. But they have to be taught how to access information on these gadgets instead of things that just serve their senses.
Mm-hmm.
So we're back to that. Can we teach people how to go to the detail like, this is a Black Talk Network. You have to really seriously turn your blinders off and see with your third eye, see with your mind. If that's too deep for you, close your eyes and listen for a minute. Mm-hmm. People have to be taught how to listen more than ever right about now. Back then, when I started my album, that's all we had. So we had to get into the theater of thought, the theater in the detail. We put out records. We didn't put out videos. We only put out videos that were able to promote a recording through a television set. But eventually it flipped around to the point where people see music first and they listen to it second. So what can a blues people do, especially in a blues time? In the United States of America, when I went to Air America, I was coming off things like, okay, I just was over in the Netherlands with some folk. I was just over in Cape Town. I was just over. So I was coming back to Air America in a critical year with internationality and also telling Black folk and us, we can never detach ourselves from the diaspora.
Mm.
Although I listened to the WLIB in the mid-80s, it was a ticket to the world. Because here I am coming from Long Island. I'm in New York. I ain't really going anywhere else. And hearing like a John Hendrick Clark or a Dr. Ben do Mark Rowley or Gary Bird show, it was a ticket to the planet Earth. Francis Cress Welsing, yo man, which was the kind of like the point of leading into making a record like Fear of a Black Planet.
I'm taking all this in, and I want to flip what I thought I was going to ask one thing, but I want to flip it. I was going to ask you to tell me more about your takeaways from being exposed to those brilliant Black voices on Black radio. You've already done that. So here's the flip side of that question. Not a bunch of young 20-somethings. I'm thinking now about the story you tell about your daughter listening to her music radio in the car with you. But not a lot of young 20-somethings are running around listening to talk radio. When I was in my early 20s, I was working for Tom Bradley, but I hadn't made my way to talk radio at that point. I am curious as to what it is about your makeup, about your experience, about your journey, about your worldview. Why, as a 20-something, were you listening to Black Talk Radio?
Well, it was a real simple answer. Like, yeah, I'm going to listen to music, but the music stations at that time got into this lock rotation. So after about a week, you got the same song coming at you.
Yeah.
You start to pick it up. And so if you're driving, a messenger, you going to sleep at a traffic light, Tavis.
Yeah.
So I had to, like, break out of that. I said, man, I got to listen to something, because I know the songs that's going to come on. They're not going to break the format.
Mm-hmm.
I got my listen to this. I got my tapes in my tape player. And lucky that my Gamble and Huff, hope that we, you know, could get together soon. Tape don't pop for the eighth time. So, you know, and turn on to the radio station. Yeah, sometimes you go to Howard Stern even, but that's a little too crazy and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all right, wow, WLIB. So it was also just a matter of circumstance that just said, yo, I got some programming that's moving.
Mm.
I got a radio station that's moving, as opposed to, like, all right, I listen to music, but you driving around after 4 days, man. It's like, yo, man, get me off this train, man. So that's what happened. But then, of course, my background also led into it. And I also like to say, Tavis, that there was a lot of people my age that was listening to Black Talk Radio. You have people, listen, when I started working, man, you know, minimum wage was $2.65. So everybody was trying to figure out, like, yo, man, I need to get, a job situation over here. And then another thing about it, not only was the city kind of decrepit at a particular time, but you definitely couldn't afford to buy anything like a house or whatever. There was just so much crime into real estate and all kinds of trickery going on that you was in tune to, like, a radio station which tells a Black person, and a Black man like me at that time, dude, you're not alone, and this is what you could do as opposed to that. There's somebody over in Brooklyn and somebody in the Bronx, because there's no reason for somebody in Brooklyn and the Bronx to even be on the same page.
Mm-hmm.
But this radio station talked to the five boroughs, talked to Long Island, New Jersey, and Connecticut from a Black community standpoint that started to realize, like, oh, this ain't just us. And what you've done on your radio station is not only connected Los Angeles to Los Angeles, but also connected Los Angeles to New York and abroad.
Yeah.
And it's jewels that are in the sand that's so there, but we have to be taught to see them. And you have to be educated, meaning that you have to learn how to see it. You know, it's the whole, you know, can lead the horse to water type of thing all over again.
Yeah.
So here we are, knowing that to break out of the plantation state of no education, no economics, no enforcement or environment that we recognize, we have to have media to be able to thrust upon information and spread it to the people and distribute to the people, although the distribution has redefined itself.
Yeah. I want to circle back, as is always the case with Chuck D's, I said at the top of the show, we'll talk about whatever he wants to talk about, because I'm just following him through this hour, because he's setting it up so nicely. I'm just trying to keep up. You said a moment ago that during your Air America days, you were, you know, traveling around the world, doing your thing on stages everywhere, Cape Town, the Netherlands, you name it, you were there. And coming back here and saying to your audience then that, specifically to Black people, that we cannot in this country be disconnected from the diaspora.
Right.
I wonder whether or not you think in this moment in late modernity, in this moment in our journey, are we more connected or less connected to the diaspora?
Our access is connected to the diaspora like never before, but it's not acknowledged because we have a certain demographic that has not been taught the importance of holding on to it for dear life.
Mm.
I told people this on national TV years ago. They thought I was crazy. I said, listen, we're in the United States of America, and I don't know. When I said this years ago, they thought I was nuts. I thought I said it on BET or something. But I said, I don't even know if the United States would be in the same shape or form in 2050. I think it might split up into five different countries, because I see five different countries based on my travels around the world, and my travels in the United States. I've been everywhere. I've driven roads. I've planed every road. I've taken boats everywhere. I was over in Germany when the wall fell. You know, I was in a place where they said, you know what, we had communism one day and now we don't know what to do. And I'm going over in the East Berlin, like it's the South Bronx with some friends. I couldn't believe that all of a sudden. And when I start my career, Tavis, I would be waking up with the whole crew waking up with dogs on that one road going from West Germany to Berlin, which is split in two. And they're waking you up with dogs and flashlights, and you better get there and not deviate off that road. So I'm waking up on one area and start my career and seeing things happen. So when I said that about the United States, I realized and said, you know, well, since we're judged by our characteristics instead of our character, and so the whole thing that Dr. King had ushered in that we work towards, and we're still being recognized all over the world by our characteristics. If you had to list the top 10 poorest countries in the world, you know, ironically, coincidentally, they have black faces, and you take the 10 richest countries in the world and they have a lack of black faces. So I'm like saying, oh, well, worldwide, I think we better understand that we are sort of the same people until we climb up out of this isms, the racism that's around the world, and get it together. And so, you know, long story short, the diaspora, to me, I always thought was strength, where I could communicate to somebody who looks just like me going through the same radiation and then figure out, like, okay, you know, we're on the same page, so we can work towards this. We can do this. And my songs in the United States, you know, they meant something. But not only to just black folk, they've meant something to a lot of people who are under oppression. And so Fight the Power meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So the diaspora, to me, you know, and when people start to talk about the diaspora is not important, I said, well, yeah, you ain't been nowhere out of, you know, Kansas City. So you got to figure out how to take care. And they ain't snapping on them. Yeah. It's like, you got to deal with your local. But I'm dealing globally. I'm giving you the news straight from the world. Don't tell me how the world is if you ain't been to the world. Because most people are judging the world based off of what they see through a screen. Screen ages. We have to say, we're all screen ages. But there's people that do real things in real places to be able to balance out your perspective.
Chuck D dropping bars, as he always has and always does. You are listening to Chuck D right now, and I could not be more thrilled about it on Tavis Smiley.
Seeking the truth. Speaking the truth. This is the Tavis Smiley Show. Made fresh daily in the Mert Park, Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Chuck D as we commemorate the 20th anniversary of the launch of Air America Radio, this progressive network that lasted for a while, but not forever, talking about those days. Chuck D was on the air then, and we've been unpacking that and some other issues as well. We were talking moments ago, Chuck, about you get my mind working, man. I've been processing this as you first said it, and that is what our white brothers and sisters can learn from us and whether or not they're willing to, in fact, learn from us. It occurs to me that when, what was it, 1988, when it Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back drops, that record, that album was acclaimed, has been acclaimed by many critics as the greatest. We're now 50 years into hip hop, 50 years plus, but many have dedicated all kinds of tributes to that project and have declared it to be the greatest hip hop album of all time. Certainly, it was instrumental in breaking rap music to white alternative rock audiences. There are three questions here, I think. The first question is, when you look back on what that album did in terms of exposing rap music to these alternative white rock audiences, you think what?
I think that, you know, in white America, we knew that there was a rebellion, that the kids wasn't going to let the access or the lack of access affect their search engine.
Mm-hmm.
When you're taught and you're told that you're one thing, there's something that's inside people that says, I'm not just going to take that and I'm going to try to figure out what the real truth is. And I think It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back was a culmination of all kinds of sight, sound, story, and style. what we experienced of being born in the 60s and some of us in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And I was able to lyrically put together what we all felt. Hank Shockley, Keith Shockley, Professor Griff, Flavor Flav, you know, all beautiful people, man. And be able to take these conversations, you know, and try to just tie it up in 160 minutes, because it was one of those things, like, if we didn't pull it off, we might have got dropped by Def Jam. Mm. So it's one of those, yeah, it was a desperation heave, but we knew how to aim the shot. So in many ways, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back was a 25-year call from the previous 25 years of everybody and everything that we've seen, and it worked almost like a news program for 60 minutes. Yeah. Fast forward to Air America, Travis. You know, I learned a great deal from Rachel Maddow, who was just a young person coming out of a college situation, internship before that. The woman never, ever slept, and doing radio. I swear to God, I used to call her Edward Murrow, because I said, there ain't nothing that's going to stop you, because the detail of what she worked with. And then also I worked with Liz Winston. We had the morning show called Unfiltered. So I was staggering in on that, and they covered my back that first hour while I was in a haze. But I learned, but these are white women who were willing to listen. They had to listen to me. Yeah. I'm riding shotgun with them. So Rachel was no joke. When you see Rachel today, understand that I saw her detail putting together a radio show every day where she put in 20 hours a day to the point that people said she was crazy. And also Liz's commitment of tying everybody together. So I was in a good zone. And then later on down the line, like Mark said earlier, Danny Goldberg, who also was my record company president in 96 and also in 99, happened to be like the head of Air America to help save it, but it was too far too late. So, you know, I met great people. I still work with Tim Einico, who was over at Air America, and Joe Zephyrin, who you know very well.
Jay-Z.
And it really seriously, you know, like broadened my horizon. I started the Rap Station Internet Network. People could go to Rap Station, RSTVApp.com, and I started the world's first cultural media app, in juxtaposition against what social media does. And we concentrate on film, art, music, sports, and we call that FAMS, because we feel that social media has just a lot of junk they can't get out the trunk. The cultural media has our story embedded in it and gives you a breath of fresh air. We started that last year and doing really well. The roots of the understanding the dynamics and the mechanics of the Tavis comes from what you do, comes with what I learned from Air America, all the way to understanding the political dynamic. And this goes back, and I don't mean to just jump right into this, but what was kind of jarring as far as the reality with Air America with me, that they felt that they had to do, that they did, that it felt funny, is that the minute that they acquired the signal from WLIB, they got rid of their black sales team. And then it was told to me, although it wasn't mentioned, that you can't sell black content or a black situation to white America without a white sales team. And that hit me like, boom. And it was almost like it wasn't printed, but I saw it clear as day, you know, to sell spots. Yeah. So here they're taking over a signal, but they still got some black people they try to say, well, see if we could get some of the old WLIB accounts from Harlem and Brooklyn. You ain't getting those. There's this detachment. They're mad that all of a sudden it ain't WLIB. It's Air America, and you got rid of your black sales team that had to take them to lunch and see them every day and get with the folks. So they got caught up in a political dynamic that they still couldn't avoid, that they tried to talk out against. I mean, we knew it from black music, because we knew, although you were doing black music in the 80s, you needed white folks at the cash register that had distribution to get you your money. It's almost like even today in television. Almost every commercial, Tavis, has a black face on it or a face of color. But what Spike Lee was saying years ago is like, well, how many black production teams are there? Yep. So we kind of like, okay, we're making inroads. But we also got to be able to clearly document the inroads and the breadcrumbs so everybody see how far we come and how far we got to go.
You said a few things I want to just unpack quickly here. In the 2 minutes I have right now, we'll continue when we come forward. In these next 2 minutes, though, tell me what you learned. I'm not naive in asking this. And Rachel is but one example. You are another. I could count to many others I've seen in my life and experience up close. But what did you learn from watching Rachel Maddow about the fact that there is no alternative for putting in the work? You've got to do the work.
That the radio show was only a small part of her day.
Mm-hmm.
the radio show was like, it was like Michael Jordan in practice, you know
mm-hmm.
what I'm saying? And by the time you get to the game, it's like, oh, the game ain't nothing. Practice is a B, you know what I'm saying? So Rachel, I mean, really, she did that. But also to recognize that you have to recognize a name for more than what it is because of the detail about a name.
Mm-hmm.
And when, for example, today, I get a sense of pride when this thing, although it's a sad incident, but when I saw Mayor Brandon Scott from Baltimore,
yeah,
and I saw the governor, Westmore,
mm-hmm.
how could a black person not feel good?
Mm-hmm.
And if somebody comes across and says, you know, what difference does it make? You know, number one, you're not on my page. And number two, if you start going in all kinds of Illuminati talk and how they're part of the government, then you should just figure out what the rest of the world works, how the rest of the world works, before you tell me about the dynamic of what you think that person is.
Mic drop. More with Chuck D when we come forward on Tab and Smiley.
Hope, agency, dignity. This is Tavis Smiley.
Can you dig it?
Come on! It's Rich Dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
Chuck D, here's my question. There is nothing wrong, I think, with being celebrated, being acknowledged, being honored by the good white folk. Nothing wrong with that. And yet, I know too many black people who are obsessed with what I would call the normative white gaze. They're just obsessed with it. They crave that normative white gaze. If, in fact, you get that opportunity, if you get access to that platform, you've had it on stages and screens and beyond, you've had it on Air America and other platforms, when you get access to that platform, whether you're craving it or not, whether it just comes to you, when you get it, what is the responsibility of a black person who has that microphone?
The responsibility to a person, especially like myself, has always been be like a prism. Because, you know, you're in the area, what they call frivolous area, bread and circus. You're in entertainment or sports. The light's going to come to you. You have to be like a prism to spread that light.
Mm.
I learned very early, you know, and also, you know, may he rest in beats and in peace. Great Lou Gossett. Lou
mm-hmm.
Gossett went to college with my mom at Pace University. He worked the bookstore. And also every time we would see him on TV, my mom said, oh, there goes Lou, you know. And every time we saw a black person on TV, it was like, man, we had to salute and honor that. But my mom knew Lou Gossett, and she said, no, he's this type of guy for real. And although I had never met him, I was like, wow, Lou Gossett was like an uncle, you know, they were like uncles and aunts in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something. And when he won his Academy Award, and I keep this with me all the time, is that when he was the officer and the gentleman, that was the example of a white person having to go through this black person to learn something.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it just wasn't reciprocated in everyday life. This white man had to go through this brother,
mm-hmm.
whether he liked it or not, and learn to get to the other side. So, I mean, so that the responsibility, and Lou Gossett also shifted his those scripts into being what he wanted to be presented as, because you're only going to be up there for a fleeting moment, especially
yeah.
back in the day. A movie was like, you go to a movie, you see it, and you ain't going to see the movie again until it pop on TV a couple of years later. It wasn't
yeah.
like, oh, yeah, I could got it and rewind and all this access that people could do with technology today. No, you had to get it in while you got it. And that Sidney Poitier slap of Mr. Tibbs.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I know people in the audience is like, can you run that back? Can I see that again? And you couldn't see it again. So it resounded.
Yeah.
I made sure that everything that we did, all my guys are great guys. Like I told you, like Hank, Flavor, Griff, everybody, you know, in our own way. We like the barbecue, baby. We don't all sometimes see the eye to eye like any other family.
Yeah.
But to the world, we are strong, we're firm, we're cordial, you know, and we're about it.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you know, the thing is, like, how do you shine light to real people doing real things? And that's what I get. I mean, I listen to KBLA, and I love the commercials. I know what the commercials mean. I also, if I'm looking and trying to figure something out, I need something to talk to me that might hit me. And it happens on TV because, you know, every time they show some a sporting event, they got the pharmaceutical companies taking over back to back to back, selling people how to fix the sickness on the same stuff that they sell them. So we get it.
I love Chuck D. Our remaining moments with him when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
What's your quarrel with the world? You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
Sounds different.
Huh. This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with Chuck D. I get goosebumps every time I get a chance to be in this brother's presence or be in dialogue with him publicly or privately. And I just honor Chuck for always taking our phone calls and coming on this program whenever we ask him to. We have been spending the last couple hours talking about Air America Radio. 20 years after its launch, Chuck was there. And he'd been regaling us with stories about what it was like to be there then and the legacy of Air America two decades later. Chuck, I'm looking at my clock here. I got about a few minutes left. Let me ask you a couple things right quick. One, you were the inaugural artist in residence at UCLA. When they did their, for their rap race and reality series with you. As you look back on that, how was the experience for you?
Oh, man, it was fantastic. I taught for 10 weeks. I had help. Dr. Sammy Aline, you know, my family, Dr. Gay Teresa Johnson, you know, they helped me out. And then they brought in their contemporaries, Jeff Chang, Davey D, people who are academic cultural sponsors. And this is what I tell people, listen, make no light of scholars. And too often we're in a time right now where people are making light of scholarship.
Oh, yeah.
Make no light of scholarship, because we as readers, Travis, and I know I'm just speaking for myself, I have 5 libraries, but I read and buy what I like.
Mm-hmm.
Scholars read everything, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pro and the con, and they have to process it into a conversation to teach. We are not scholars. I'm a person, I'm a culturalist. And I try to merge my culture with my activism and go forward from there. But when we disregard scholars, Dr. John Hendrick Clark read until he was blind.
That's right.
Bro, I mean, we don't confuse yourself with knowing a little bit about something and being an expert at it. We are all students, but scholars are underappreciated, and especially in this society. So I salute to the scholars. Yeah, you know, that set me up in that program.
Well said, well said. The last 2 minutes belong to you. And here's my exit question. I don't have time to get into all this going on in the world, but you travel the world. You see more than most of us. At this moment in American history, how are you sustaining your hope, Chuck D?
Sustaining my hope by hopefully, you know, talking to as many people outside the 2,000 by 3,000 lower 48 box, which is a hot box. We follow the NFL and the NBA more than our current state right now, and that has to be reversed. I tell people to go over to bringthenoiseapp.com. It's the world's first cultural media. No, I kind of like, you know, it's not for politics because, you know, but you know what? Within the culture, there's a lot in there that move us to understanding, you know, political stances in the world right now, situations. I mean, it's a shame, you know, like for a place that's so close, like Haiti, we know so little or been taught to give so little care about it. And so many dynamics. So I'm just saying, listen, Tavis, I'm a big sports fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if I got stats in my head about my favorite teams and the Lakers and the Knicks and you know, the Kansas City Chiefs, and I can't name every state in the country, and I can't name 10 countries in Africa, or I can't name 20 countries in the entire world out of 215 That means I have something as a human being to not consider me an alien to the planet. Work on that.
Another mic drop. Work on that. That's how you close. Okay. That's how you close. Work on that. Work
Tavis,
on it. Yes, sir.
Tavis, man, you're my hero, man. Seriously. And most of my heroes don't appear on the stand.
You are kind. You are kind, and I love you, man. You have you've advanced the culture in more ways than we have time to acknowledge in these few seconds. But I am always grateful. I am deeply indebted. Always humbled by your appearance anywhere with me. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I appreciate you. I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it, Chuck D. I just love you, man.
Call me anytime, bro. Salute.
Stay strong. More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.